for August 18th, 2018. Welcome to Superfly Oz podcast number 62. I am he, Superfly Oz himself, Stan Fitchman, here to give you insight and perspective, trustworthy insight and perspective of what is going on around the world, across the United States, and here in my little corner of the world of the McCully section of downtown Honolulu, state of Hawaii, United States of America. I am so glad that you're here on the 62nd edition of the Superfly Oz podcast, and I'm really excited about this episode. But first, let's get some housekeeping items done. If you're looking to reach out to Superfly Oz and let them know what's going on, please go ahead, go to your email browser, and go to sjfhawaii@gmail.com. sjfhawaii@gmail.com. Write up an email. Send it to me. If it is good enough, I will put it on the air and also respond to it, maybe even through email itself. A lot of people have been doing that these last few weeks, so I really do appreciate those listeners who are outreaching to me and asking me for my perspective of what is going on, especially here in Hawaii, right after the primary election. If you're looking to go to the website where the Superfly Oz podcast is located and look for other episodes of the Superfly Oz podcast, go to www.politicshawaii.com. Politicshawaii.com is where you're going to find all of the episodes of the Superfly Oz podcast. Almost for a whole year, ladies and gentlemen. So go ahead and listen in. Download it if you'd like to in order to make sure that you don't cut your bandwidth down. And listen in on all the perspective and insight as to what was going on between now and even from before. Again, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I'm really excited about this program. I know I always am excited about my programs, but this one year, I still am so excited about. So let me just kind of dive right into it. Today, we have a great interview going on. Right after the primary election was done, I got an email from a friend of mine who I hang out with on occasion, and he knows my family, and I know his family relatively well. His name is Bixby Ho. He is the former chair of the Oahu County Democratic Party, and I got to see him quite a bit over at the governor's party over at the Pagoda Hotel last weekend. And right after the interview was done, after all the podcasts were done for last week, he emailed me out and he says, "Hey, I'd like to come on the show and give you some of my mana'o as to what happened during the primary." And I thought to myself, that is just exactly what this show needs. Let me give you a little perspective before we get into the interview. The interview, by the way, is about 31 minutes, so please forgive me for it being a little long today, but I think you should really receive this type of perspective. As you very well know, over the last week or so, there has been a lot of pundits going out there and saying, okay, this is what happened here, this is what happened there, this is why this person lost, this is why this person won. And a lot of it is from pundits who are, well, you know, just like me, reading the paper, looking at things, maybe even talking to a few people, doing a lot of off-record type of talking. But none of the pundits are really insiders. Now, Bixby, he is an insider. He is one who actually works in campaigns. He's actually worked on a couple of campaigns during this last election cycle, and he'll mention that during the interview itself. Plus, also, he has some great insight as to what's going on at the Democratic Party itself that he is willing to share with the listeners of the Superfly Oz program today. So I really was excited about the fact, because, yeah, you can bring on other pundits, and I'm not going to name them or anything like that, but again, there would be, we'd just be kind of agreeing on the same things that we were looking at in regard to reading the tea leaves or the Star Advertiser or whatever was out there in regard to what was happening in the election. But this here, ladies and gentlemen, this is where we really get some insight knowledge as to what is going on. And this is the type of stuff that I'm really excited about in regard to how this podcast is going to go. So without further ado, I want to go ahead and just get into the interview right now. And I'll have a few comments as to what the interview meant afterward. But ladies and gentlemen, here he is, Bixby Ho, former chair of the Oahu Democratic Party, here on the Superfly Oz podcast. Welcome to the show, Bixby.
Mahalo, Stan. Great to be here.
So what happened? So let's start talking about some of the races, and let's just dive right into it. So we had the governor's race. We had Colleen Hanabusa and David Ige, and David Ige won by 6 percentage points. So after the fact that he was basically left for dead starting at around February or March, and then he just made his comeback kid moment. And I think that the second readout that happened over at the Ige party really showed that, which is what I recorded last weekend. What are your insights about that race? I mean, how did he come back? What was the secret sauce that he had to drink in order to make that happen?
I don't think it was any secret sauce, Stan, per se. I think it was just the pure intellectual ingenuity of the electorate, which basically said, we don't need third people to tell us what went wrong and what went right. You know, the main issue that Colleen ran on was the missile scare of January 13th, something that's going to forever live in our heads. But, you know, ultimately, she didn't have any concrete plans for our future, you know, and except for, yeah, we're going to just forever know David Ige as the button pusher. But as everybody well knows, he didn't push the button.
So that's a very interesting thing. So he came back from literally being written off because of that missile scare. What was the one thing, or what were the couple of things? I have a couple of ideas as to what it is, but I'd like to hear from you. What was it that Ige did to reverse all that? Because unlike his predecessor, Governor Neil Abercrombie, he never was able to make a comeback like what Ige did. And everybody was kind of writing and saying, well, Governor Ige is looking like he's like Neil Abercrombie, which is like, you know, he's going to lose and we're going to have yet another governor, you know, third one in 8 years. What was it that turned it all around?
Well, it definitely wasn't any snooty attitudes. You know, honestly, Governor Ige ran on his results, you know, proven results. He's not a Governor Ariyoshi, soft but effective. He was vocal and very effective. You know, he understood what went into understanding the matrix of working with a legislature and turned it around to fulfill a lot of goals within the 4 years instead of lofty goals. He reached out to goals that people wanted to hear, like air-conditioned classrooms, bettering the environment, you know, passing, of course, the very first oxybenzone ban in sunscreens. That's huge. And, of course, stepping up against the current administration on the Paris Climate Agreement.
So another question that I would have in regard to the philosophy of Governor Ige. Governor Ige, in certain circles, is looked at as actually kind of a fiscal conservative, socially liberal type of person, which is kind of around where the middle of everybody is, in the middle of the political spectrum. But now he sounds more like he's a progressive because he is advocating for clean energy. He's advocating for not LNG as a bridge, which is what Hanabusa actually promoted. And he's promoting more along that. And a couple of other analysis says that he was very key in getting the progressive vote, in getting a win in the primary election. Are we looking at Hawaii now making that pivot to more of a progressive type of Democrat? Or are we still kind of in the middle of the road here in regard to how things are, you know, being socially liberal but fiscally conservative?
Well, Governor Ige comes from the perspective of the legislature. You know, the last time we actually had a governor that came from the legislature was Ben Cayetano. You know, so, you know, fiscal conservatism, it came from because of the fact that Governor Ige, before his stint as governor, was Senate Ways and Means Chair, so he understood the ways and means of the state budget and how to balance it without realizing that, hey, we cannot or we should live within our means.
And I think that's one thing that a lot of electorate was looking at when it came to actually voting for Ige, to say he will consider and continue to be a person who will be looking at kind of the bottom line in regard to how things are spent in the state of Hawaii. So you mentioned about the legislature in your last answer, and so I wanted to bring up the legislature. Now, there's a bunch of interpretations that are out there as to how that relationship is going to be now that David Ige is going to be most likely the next governor of the state of Hawaii, or he'll have his second term. And most of the legislature, or most of the legislative leaders, were against him, and they came out very vocally against him during the primary. So what happens to legislature? There's interpretations as to whether or not they should negotiate and maybe come out with a joint package, or there's going to be like an uproar over at the House and Senate. Where do you see things are going to go between the legislature and Governor Ige once he gets elected?
Well, we should see. You know, this past primary, there were a lot of incumbents that were voted out. A lot of them, you know, there's a possibility that there could be a major swift but gentle change in the legislature. I'm not going to exactly quote myself as saying what I know and what I shouldn't know. You know, as everybody's watching through the TV and, of course, Civil Beat, understanding what's going on with the legislative leaders, there's always a possibility of a shakeup, but every election there's always a talk of the shakeup, but never happens.
Well, I've always also heard of shakeups and stuff like that, but of course, nothing ever happens until after it happens, right, Bixby?
Exactly.
So why don't we move on? We're actually going to get back to talking about some of the other races that happened lower than the statewide races, but I wanted to pivot real quick right now and talk about the lieutenant governor's race. Now, that was a completely different nature of a race.
Yes, indeed. That was a major shell shocker. We saw from all aspects of the legislature running, we saw Dr. Josh Green, former Senator Willis Sparrow, current sitting Senator Joe Takuda, current Kauai Mayor Bernard Carvalho, among others. You know, it was quite a very eclectic group, you know, so you saw basically different sides of the legislature running, you know, and ultimately, I don't know exactly what happened. You know, I'm not going to lie, I did support Willis Sparrow because of the fact that he, you know, came out convincingly strong for the environment and something that I myself believed heavily in, but of course, at the end of the day, the electorate spoke. So, I honestly couldn't tell you if it was a referendum on strengthening the lieutenant governor's seat or just making sure there's a placeholder for the possible EA Part Two.
So, a lot of people are talking about the amount of money that was expended on this race for a lieutenant governor's race, where it's pretty much, you know, it's the second ranked guy to the governor, and pretty much, you know, he does whatever the governor wants him to do. There was a lot of money spent, and a lot of people are saying that it's because the Carpenters wanted to go after Takuda for her position on the rail and basically kiboshing a bill back at the legislature in 2017 in regard to the spending of it. But I think that that's only part of it. I mean, do you see it just because of the fact that they wanted to exact revenge on Joe Takuda?
No, I don't think that the Carpenters had any kind of sway in that. I think it was ultimately just how effective the campaigns were in getting out their message, you know, not only through Facebook or social media, but they've also tapped, you know, of course, our mail and also the TV and radio, you know, and ultimately whoever basically it boiled down to the goldfish mentality where 5 seconds before you walk into the poll, the last name you see, kind of deal.
That's very interesting. So the ticket is now Josh Green and David Ige for the Democratic side. And we also know that Andrea Tupola and Marissa Kearns is over on the Republican side. And we already know that Marissa Kearns, in regard to her campaign for lieutenant governor, has already gone after her running mate, which is the governor. I mean, I don't know if you have any insight in regard to Marissa Kearns, just for our audience here, just to give it some context as to what we're going to be seeing moving ahead.
I don't have any personal insight on Marissa Kearns. However, I have seen her debate, and her style of debate, it may be a bit too harsh for the state, you know, because we need a compassionate yet strong candidate. You know, we don't need a ironclad, fisting, pounding candidate telling us what we should hear. We need an open hand, an open dialogue kind of candidate, and I don't believe Marissa Kearns is going to be that candidate. And honestly, I think the Republicans just forgot that there was a guy named Jeremy Lowe, Republican candidate for lieutenant governor, that ran. I swear people you know, kept repeating that name, and I kept hearing that name in my head too, so I'm sure something happened, or people were like, oh, maybe we should try creating the diversity of all-female versus all-male election.
You know, that's actually very interesting that you should say that. So we have a Filipino lieutenant governor and a Samoan governor candidate on the Republican side, and we have a Japanese governor candidate and a Haole on, or Caucasian, I should say, being politically correct, on the Democratic side. So, I mean, that's an extremely interesting dynamic, and we're just going to have to see, right? So you're going to bring the popcorn for the first debate, right, right, Bixby?
With kakimochi and furikake all over it. I just wanted to correct you real quick, Stan, that Governor Ige is Okinawan descent, not Japanese. Yeah,
I have to remember that. And for the listeners who are from the mainland who would probably put the two together and say, well, same difference. Folks here in Hawaii who are of Okinawan descent are very much provincial to the island itself. And they very much are proud of the fact that they are not Japanese. They are Okinawan. So thank you very much, Bixby, for that correction. Good point, and I appreciate that. Hopefully when the governor listens to us, he won't take offense to that.
Let's hope not either.
So let's move on to the other races now. I want to start with CD2, or the Congressional District 2, because that seemed to be just one of those races that was so lopsided. You know, you had Sherry Kapanaga and Tulsi Gabbard. And Tulsi Gabbard took it, what, by 60%, 70%, somewhere around there. What's your insights about that race? Because at the end, there was a lot of social media stuff that was coming out about Tulsi Gabbard and her, well, her supposed links with some members in the Hindu community here in Hawaii, on the mainland, as well as in India itself. So what's your insight on that?
Honestly, I don't think religion had anything to do with it. I think it was just Tulsi's inability to effectively campaign. But yet, because of her visibility in Congress, and people see her as a leader because of the fact that she wears the National Guard uniform, it did hold a lot of clout. For Sherry Campagna, it was hard for her trying to spend a good majority of the time just trying to get her name and face out there. You know, rural Hawaii, or the second congressional district, is not as easy to go about. It's not like congressional district 1, which is urban Honolulu, where you can just jump on H1, jump on H2, there you are. For congressional district 2, it's literally island hopping, and that's basically anywhere from 45 to 50 minutes from Honolulu to Hilo. And then from Hilo to Kauai, that's almost an hour and a half flight right there. So you lose a lot of ground because of the fact that you have to keep bouncing. So honestly, I think it was just that Sherry didn't have enough time to get her name and face recognition, which was heavily needed, especially for the CD2 race.
You know, just as a comparison, I hear a lot from my job, of course, in regard to Alaska also being that much of a challenge too for people to get out, especially to like places like Nome and to Dillingham and all those other areas in Alaska. So those places also have those challenges too. So I think pretty much it was a blowout in regard to Congressional District 2. Of course, again, Tulsi Gabbard just took it. So I think we'll just probably leave it here for right now. And let's talk about that more exciting race, the Congressional District 1 race, or the H1 race. <It's>, So, as we all know, Ed Case, who was a former congressman, he ran for Senate against Dan Akaka back in 2006, and he lost, and he lost a few races after that. He came back in at the last minute and just took the pole position right away. I mean, it was 30 seconds afterward, and everybody else was just trying to catch up and try to play second, try to win second place, which was done by Doug Chin. What's your initial insights in regard to that race?
You know, the darnest thing is that I think it ultimately came down to name recognition. You know, although Ed Case, yes, has, you know, lost a bit of races and went into the private sector for a while, he, you know, he licked his wounds a couple of times. You know, he also ran, if not too many people remember, in 2012 for the special election to replace the late Senator Danny Noy. But opportunity came a-knocking. So, you know, Ed saw the opportunity to come back in, and because of the fact that as a former member of Congress, as you just eloquently mentioned, that once he returns, he automatically will be able to resume that special seat of seniority. I think he's like at seat number 219 as opposed to seat number 435. So maybe that's a big win for the state now.
So basically, he served Congress for, what, 7 years? Is that correct? About?
About 7 years, I believe so.
And you get middle rank position right away if you come back afterward. That's a very interesting piece. So I want to know from your point of view in regard to what happens now to certain candidates that also ran in CD2. And, of course, this had a lively group of people. I mean, everybody from Kaniele Ng, who did his thing, all the way to Donna Mikado Kim, who tried again in regard to this. Does this race really just kind of solidify that seat and just says, you know what, as long as Ed Case is in that seat, nobody's going to be able to touch it? And what about these other guys who seem to think that they might be able to go at it again? Let's talk about Donna Mikado Kim for a second.
Well, Donna, honestly, she's a great woman. You know, don't get me wrong. You know, she's served her time very well in both the city council, state legislature, you know, both as council chair and as Senate president. And she was hoping for elevation, but not too many people were keen, especially when it came to the very first debate. I think the only publicly televised debate that she was wrong on a very personal but public issue that, you know, and she never took the fall for, you know. So she's become more of the forgetful, I'm not sure, or just the I'm right, you're wrong.
So because this race had, and all of these races that we are talking about here had so many different types of people in there, everything from Jill Takuda for lieutenant gun all the way to, you know, Ernie Martin for the CD1 race, is it the winner takes it all and everybody else has to just go back and lick their wounds? Or are we really looking at a new set of candidates that will be running for different offices coming up in 2020, 2022, and et cetera, et cetera?
I think we're going to see a new brand of candidates running. You know, this year in particular, there was a lot of animosity from the 2016 presidential election still deep ingrained in a lot of people's heads. To quickly reference on what happened in 2016 with the presidential election was the Democratic primary, the Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders race in particular, and a lot of Democrats or Bernie-crats versus Clinton-crats, you know, said, you know what, we want to run on a Bernie issue or a Hillary issue, and it was still really, really deep ingrained in a lot of these candidates. So that's why you saw candidates like Kaniele Ng, Beth Fukumoto, the David Ige versus Colleen Hanabusa race. But at the same time, for the David Ige versus Colleen Hanabusa race, that was a bit of an interesting one because both of those candidates supported Hillary. However, one, of course, was able to sway the Bernie people to say, hey, you know what, you guys still have a vote. So that's part of the reason why they leaned towards Ige.
So moving off of the headlining races of Lieutenant Governor, and Congressional District 1, who, by the way, thank you very much, Bixby, for all of that insight. Let's talk about the other local races that happen here. And there's a whole bunch of them, so we're not going to get into it all into the show. And tell me from your perspective, as being the former chair of the Oahu County Democratic Party, what races, the lower ticket races, were interesting to you?
One that stood out the most was your area in particular, Stan, which was the Brickwood Goletaria versus Sharon Moriwaki race. You know, this is, of course, Senate District 12. You know, so it was very interesting. Everybody's like, you know, Brickwood, of course, everybody remembers his days on the radio. Before that, of course, he was on TV with Hawaii's Kitchen. And before that, you know, of course, the radio, and of course, he's an entertainer, of course, former party chair. But ultimately, I think it ultimately came down to physical presence instead of digital presence. You know, Hawaii is not one of the places where you want to just go all digital. You want to have at least a physical presence out there in the community, because there are a lot of people that do not use social media as their main norm, unlike myself, which I do, but I still get out there in the community, and face-to-face engagement worked. So that's why I believe Sharon ultimately won. I believe it was like a 2-1 margin.
Yes, it was. It was actually pretty much of a blowout. You know, it's interesting about Sharon, because I think that, probably not go into it all, but, you know, her background and where she came from. She literally came from nowhere, but she doesn't necessarily come from, like, an absolute anonymity. I mean, she's been in the community before. She's been participatory. I will make mention that her husband is Galen Fox, who is a former representative at the state legislature. And I know that he may have been helping. I don't know. We don't know. But does she really stand on her own in regard to how this new legislature is going to be?
She does. And ultimately, you know, as you were talking about her previous experience, I've known Sharon for almost 20 years, ever since I got involved with the party the very first time as a little sprout. But I've gotten to work with Sharon, and I've seen exactly what kind of community activism she has provided, as well as party activism, you know. And of course, I do remember succinctly that, you know, of her, I wouldn't say infinite, but finite knowledge of, you know, local politics and how to effectively run a campaign. I don't know how effective Galen was into it. It was possibly that he was able to woo some of the Republicans to say, yeah, we'll pick Sharon over Brickwood.
So that's very interesting. On my own personal observation of Sharon is the fact that she really hustled. And she hustled a lot more than Brickwood Galateria did. I saw a couple of posters out there for Brickwood. If you noticed last week when I was on my broadcast, I had made some observations what was going on around the polling place that day. And I noticed that there was a Brickwood Galateria sign that was just kind of abandoned off to the side while Kaneala Ying's people were kind of doing some sign waving right there at the corner. Did Brickwood really even try to win this, or did he just assume that he was going to win it outright? What's your feeling about that?
My personal take, and this is an insult to Brickwood, although Brickwood and I go way back, I've honestly did not see him effectively campaigning. You know, like I was just talking about the physical versus the digital presence. You know, he was out there fundraising, yes, but he wasn't fundraising to the constituency. He was fundraising to everything else around him, you know, and of course, ultimately, it's for a race of this magnitude, you want to touch the people in your community. You don't want to be out there farther than your community expecting a win, because it doesn't work.
One race that I do want to bring up and to share with you is the upcoming race in regard to Val Okamoto versus Marilyn Lee. That's going to be an interesting race. I mean, you have two very interesting dynamic people with two very interesting backgrounds in regard to it. Of course, Val Okamoto was a supporter of Beth Fukumoto when she was out there. And of course, Marilyn Lee was the former representative out there for many, many years. Just as kind of a spitballing kind of thing, because I think that's one of the more interesting races, because there is actually possibly a Republican maybe pickup, or at least a really hard challenge to Marilyn Lee. What's your take in regard to that race coming up in the general?
Marilyn, of course, as not too many people remember, several years ago took the seat from her late husband, Sam Lee. And so she's been in the legislature before, like you mentioned. A lot of people realize that, you know, Beth, of course, being the young and upcoming person that beat her in the last election, but this time Marilyn, I think, just is looking for more of redemption. It's hard to say exactly, because both Val and Marilyn, you know, as much time as I love to spend in Mililani, which is like next to like a few days of the year, I see how the dynamic roles, and a lot of people saying that, you know, they just want somebody who's going to be able to perform well for their community.
So that should be an interesting thing going to the polls. Any other thoughts in regard to the primary? And this is just more of in general. I mean, was it a good primary? Was it something that was actually beneficial for the state of Hawaii? Or are we looking at, like, man, we just kind of blew the coop in regard to the patience of the voter because we put out so many people there? I kind of hear it from both sides. What's your take on us all?
Honestly, I think it's calling for a referendum to do an all-mail ballot. You know, I'm ever since right after the primary, Sunday morning, I Facebook posted, hey, it's time for an all-mail ballot because of the very fact that this was another lackluster, dare say, of turnout for the state of Hawaii. You know, this was not the lowest, thank goodness, but it came pretty darn close, and the turnout was just very dismal. You know, I was looking at the numbers. It's like, this is really, really bad. This is not a, you know, referendum saying that, you know, people have lost confidence in their electorate, but they have lost confidence in the voting system because of, like you said, so many people running.
So my last question to you, and I'm really hoping that we can get a good insight in regard to this. So we were taking a look at the political philosophies of all the candidates that were running in the primary. And as we know, Colleen Hanabusa was pretty much backed by a faction that was also known as people who were backing Dan Inouye, who was the Supreme Senator here in the state of Hawaii for many, many years. And there was also another dynamic that happened in regard to Ed Case winning the seat back again, basically after running against Dan Akaka in 2006 and everybody basically saying that he was he was blackballed in running for office ever again. Have we really seen a political fundamental change in which certain philosophies that we held on to for so many years, like a Dan Inouye type of philosophy, and the feeling that, you know, the senior senators were incorruptible and you couldn't throw a stone at them and hurt them or do anything like that. Have we really had a fundamental change in the philosophy of politics here in Hawaii, especially at the Democratic Party side, in regard to the results that came from this race?
We have, because I think it was just as early as, you know, 2012, when the last time we ever heard the saying, hey, what does your tutu or your grandmother or your grandparents tell you who you should vote for? You know, back in the day, I remember it very well that going to these campaign events, it was all about, you know, of course, the kupuna, but as, of course, they are slowly fading away, that the newer generations that are replacing them are not as interested, you know, in the elections as how we were back then. You know, so I think ultimately it was just because of our perseverance to just hear what our relatives said about certain candidates, and we stuck with it. But nowadays, because there's all kinds of media for candidates to have a field day on, you know, it's ultimately, I think, just a matter of cosmetics.
So one last thing in regard to the Democratic Party that I thought was rather interesting was the fact that after the new chair, I noticed that there was a lot more outreach to the community of the party in regard to showing off candidates, kind of like that meet and greet that was done over at IAA High School that you nicely reminded me to go to. And I went to, and I saw a number of friends over there. But is that the new way that the Democratic Party's got to go out there and actually still kind of promote their ways? Because even before, when Tim Vanderveer was running, I didn't see that type of outreach. So is this a new approach by the party?
It's not a new approach, but it is a very innovative and effective way of getting out there, because of the fact that our membership roles are dropping because everybody's not interested in, you know, aligning in the party. So, you know, one way to get people knowing that there is still a Democratic Party is through community engagement.
So that's very interesting. And we'll have to see if that continues on with the chair of the Democratic Party, especially when it comes up to this general election, which, unfortunately, I got to just tell you, and I'll just give you my inside, Bixby, is like, you know, the results, a lot of the results were done in the primary. And I think everybody has been saying that as their analysis. And so we'll have to see if the Democratic Party still gets out there and still shows off these candidates, Case, Ige, et cetera, for people to really come to understand, okay, here's your new leadership and here's who out. Any final thoughts, my friend?
Just vote blue come November, folks.
or vote your conscience, ladies and gentlemen. And you know that's going to be one of the things that Superfly Oz here is going to be advocating for. Vote your conscience, whether it's blue, red, green, yellow, whatever other color, right, Bixby?
Well, yes. Thanks for bringing up green. Yes. Just remember, Josh is on the ballot.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bixby Ho. Now, you're going to be back on the show. Maybe we can get you back on the show after the general is done. How about that?
With pleasure, Stan.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bixby Ho, former chair of the Oahu County Democratic Party, good friend of Superfly Oz, and hopefully something of a normal guest on the show. Mahalo. Once again, I want to thank my friend Bixby Ho for coming over to the Superfly Oz Central studio and giving his mana'o or his knowledge in regard to what happened during the primary election here in the state of Hawaii this last weekend. And with that, folks, I'm pretty sure that you're anxious to move on to other things or to listen to other episodes of the Superfly Oz podcast. So I'm going to let you go from here. Once again, remember, if you want to listen to this show and listen to the other shows of the Superfly Oz podcast, go to www.politicshawaii.com. Politicshawaii.com is where you're going to be able to find the Superfly Oz podcast. Also, if you want to email me, go ahead, go to sjfhawaii@gmail.com, sjfhawaii@gmail.com. I'm really happy to announce that I'm going to just leave this as the last item on the show today. For the first Wednesdays of September and October of this year, I'm going to be on the radio. I'll be on AM 940, the 808 State Update, that is Duke Iona's show. And I'm going to be sitting in, believe it, for the Duke himself and going ahead and just giving my mana'o in regard to what is going on around. So I want to thank my friend Jack James for giving me the opportunity to get onto the radio once again. And as you know, it's always going to be balanced from my perspective as to what is going on around the world, across the United States, and here in my little corner of the McCully section of downtown Honolulu, state of Hawaii, United States of America. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Superfly Oz podcast. We'll see you next week.